Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
All right, welcome back. So we're looking at the Sunday papers. We have Paul Kimmage of the Sunday Independent in the studio with us and Gary O'Toole. Gents, you're both very welcome. Thanks for popping in.
Joe.
Thank you.
So we're streaming on Facebook and in all the usual places, and we're obviously on the radio as well. I'll go through the back pages firstly. The Sunday World have Poch is gonna stay. So that's Pochettino, who has told Daniel Levy that he's gonna stay on as Spurs manager. We have the back page of the Sunday Mirror, and it's Solskjaer as well. You're going to have to wait. So Manchester United saying they're not rushing the decision. And down here in the bottom, Mart so keen on Roy reunion. Martin O'Neill and Nottingham Forest beat Wigan 3-1 yesterday. Roy Keane was in the stands, and Martin O'Neill has said he certainly wants Roy to come and join them sometime very soon. And then, oh, actually, Gary O'Toole, this might interest you. £6,000 a ticket for Kop title bash. So Liverpool's final home game of the season, the hottest ticket in football, already being offered for a staggering £6,000 sterling to be there for that final match, assuming all goes well. Star Sport then. Shocks and awe, this is FA Cup yesterday. Pep's rampant City blast 5. That's a 5-0 win for City over Burnley. But up here you'll see West Ham and Everton both dumped out of the FA Cup by lower league opposition. And then Sun Sport, they have the family of Emiliano Sala here. They don't want to see black armbands on English football teams just yet, because they are still praying and hoping that Sala is still alive. Then we have the Sunday Independent. A picture of Seamus Callan last night, Tipperary beating Clare. Tip top, Callan on fire as Premier shine in opening night win. And this will, I'm sure, qualify as a grenade. Joe Schmidt was talking about Eddie Jones's grenades during the week. So Schmidt at the Six Nations launch during the week was talking to the Sunday papers, and he's talking about how Ireland have been the victims of spying. We were kind of disappointed when we found out, he says. I don't think it's necessary. I know it's happened to us. And he said he stumbled on it, but would not disclose who had been involved in the espionage. He says, I think when it filters back, you're disappointed, but you kind of acknowledge, okay, it's their process, it's their way of collecting information. You just shrug your shoulders. Elsewhere, Eddie Jones was talking about how he used to spy all the time as well. So obviously with Bielsa, this was being talked about during the week. And then last one or two. Mail on Sunday, timely tip. Sheedy side beat Clare in league opener, but boss says that red card for Kelly made all the difference. That was Tony Kelly's red card. And the Sunday Times, big FA Cup picture. It's Matt Doherty, Republic of Ireland international, who scored a crucial goal yesterday for Wolves. And also the Joe Schmidt spying story is on the front page as well. And then Observer, Den Delight. This is Millwall, Everton. Wallace's late strike shocks Everton, and they boast their Six Nations preview as well. So they are your front pages this afternoon. You're both very welcome. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Joe. £6,000 sterling is a lot of money, but probably worth it in the end if they do win it on the final day. It would be great if it went down to the final day, I'd have to say. Waited a long time for it. And with the fee that I'm getting for this appearance this afternoon, I can easily afford it. I'll bring you along too, Joe, if you want.
No, he gets in for nothing.
Oh.
Yeah, we thank you just for bringing the cakes again. That's more than appreciated.
You're more than welcome, Joe.
So, Hugh McIlvany is the obvious place to start, isn't he?
I think so. I'll defer to Paul. You knew him.
Yeah, I did know him. There's a report on the Mayo Roscommon game last night. I thought about this. So a report on the Mayo Roscommon game of Michael Clifford, and there's a line in it. He's talking about the slapstick proportions of the game. And there's a line in it that says, in keeping with the Laurel and Hardy feel to the evening. So what age are you?
50.
50. Joe?
33.
You ever hear Laurel and Hardy?
Rings a bell, yeah.
Right. Just the bell.
Rings a bell.
I'm joking, come on.
Okay, you're right, okay. But just well, everyone knows
everyone
Laurel
knows
and Hardy.
Them, yeah.
Everyone knows.
Yeah,
there's a new movie out last week, Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, I know that, but yeah. Really, you say everyone knows it. People under the age of 50 wouldn't really appreciate Laurel and Hardy. I mean, I did. I thought they were fantastic. But okay. I don't think people under the age of 50 really would.
Well, like everything in sport, there's always comes with a a competitor. You know, you're Laurel and Hardy or you're Abbott and Costello. You know, you couldn't be both fans.
Right,
of both,
now you're confusing Joe. He has no idea who Abbott and Costello are. So
I remember a friend of mine checking into the Shelburne Hotel with his partner, and they'd come off a long flight from California, and as they were checking into the Shelburne, the guy who was greeting them said, "This is the hotel where Laurel and Hardy stayed." That's a very famous hotel in Dublin there, Laurel and Hardy.
Right.
Where are we going with this? We're talking about Hugh McElvenny.
As a preface to Hugh McElvenny, I mean, were you a reader? Did you know him? Did you read him? Joe?
Not enough. No, not enough.
No. Yeah. See, I'm interested in that as well, because again, you had to be really to appreciate McElvenny. I would suggest you probably had to be 50, really. Anything younger than that, you wouldn't really have appreciated how good he was and what he did and why the papers are so full of him today, really, I suppose. Yeah,
well, you had to be 50 plus, you had to be getting English papers into the into your household.
That's not common.
We used to get all the papers on a Sunday into our house, but rarely would we get an English paper. And he was writing for The Observer. If you did get an English paper, it would have been The Times on Sunday. So it was before the internet and the easy access to these articles. So an awful lot of these articles and his quotes have come as new to me.
Yeah.
And fortunately, the papers have put a lot of his articles up online, which is good for us.
In the coverage today, I think Tommy Conlon sets the tone of it perfectly with his intro. When a beloved figure enjoys a long and quiet retirement, the pangs of sadness provoked by their final parting are often softened by the slow fade into privacy that preceded it. So it's the pangs of sadness, really, I think, that a lot of us people above 50 and who work in the newspaper business and in sports in particular have been feeling since it was announced that Hugh had passed away. And that's reflected pretty much in all of the coverage today. The sadness of the passing of someone who was not just a sports writer, but an iconic writer himself. Mm. And that's reflected again in the wit of the coverage today. You know, there are a lot of great pieces. The one that I really, really enjoyed was in the news review, actually, of the Sunday Times, and it was written by Donald Trafford, who was his editor when he was at The Observer, when Hugh was at his best, really. And he's written a tremendous piece about what it was like to work with Hugh McElvenny. And one paragraph in particular jumped out because I could relate to it. And he's talking about his genius, and the quote is, "These flashes of wit, though typical of his conversation, belie the agony that went into his writing." Mm. In 2005, I shared a house with him at St Andrews during the Open. There was four Sunday Times writers there. And Hugh was with us. And I remember coming back. I was ghosting Nick Faldo, and I was finished early for once in my entire career. And came back to the house, and Hugh was in his room. And Pat Collins, another great writer from the Mail, alluded to this earlier in the week. He'd been with him in Vegas, covering the fight, world title fight, about 30 years ago. And he told a story about coming into Hugh's room on the morning after he'd filed his piece, and just like a bomb had hit the room, just paper everywhere, coffee cups. And what that meant, it was the effort that McElvenny, he was sitting there with a sheaf of this copy in his hand, he was going through it, blind, you know. And I got a real sense of that from that weekend, that week I spent with McElvenny at the Open in 05. I hadn't really appreciated his genius at that stage, because I think, and this is not something that will be said and is ever said, we all have a sell-by day. And I think Hugh's sell-by day had passed when he went to the Sunday Times. I don't think we saw anything like the McElvenny we saw in The Observer when he was at the Sun Times, and certainly during my time at the Sunday Times, he was gone by his best at that stage.
When would he have went to the Sunday Times, give or take?
He went in 93.
Okay.
He went in 93. Now, I joined in 2003, 2002. So certainly during my time with him, he was definitely gone by his best. But what really, really, really endeared me to him that week was the effort and the diligence and the devotion to his craft. Like, to witness it was actually unbelievable. I really was blown away by every word. The words still matter to him. Mm. And I made dinner for the four of us that night, and he came in, poured him a large glass of Gigondas, and he had his dinner, and he went back out to the conservatory and was regaling us with all stories about his career and all, as he normally did. And he watched as I watched his plate, and I was more than happy to do it, because that's how good he was.
You fed him and cleaned up after him.
Yeah.
I think that he definitely benefited. There was the perfect timing for him, because he was in the greatest period for journalists too, because they had, you know, good, meaningful access to sports people. You know, you got hours with them. And that your piece last week with Kenny came across, that was meaningful access with someone, instead of now that you're trying to cobble together some of their Instagram posts into an article that might be printed in the newspaper. This was proper journalism, which I was saying to you earlier on, he might be the first of those journalists to be washed up on, or the last of those journalists to be washed up on the shore, and everyone else then is a carbon copy, but less and less less and less of the old school. And there's a new generation of journalists coming in, the Twitter, the Instagram, the Periscope, everything else that I don't understand, and I can't fathom, you know, where journalism is going now, for me, as a person that just enjoys reading it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just that he was eking out, this is what comes across with all the coverage, you know, I've seen you too, you know, agonizing over columns, or you've recounted how you've done it, and that's what comes out with him. But he was obviously quick-witted too, you know, because they quote him about his quips, and he's very famous for what he said about Ali and about Joe Bugner. When he was talking about Joe Bugner, in his prime, Joe Bugner had the physique of a Greek statue, but fewer moves. If talent were elastic, Joe's pants would fall down. So you can think about that, you can write that down, and you have hours to consider it. But when you're in a press conference and Joe Bugner calls out and he says, get me Jesus Christ, I'll fight him. And McIlvany is straight back and he says, Joe, you're only saying that because he has bad hands, you know. So you don't, he was obviously an extremely quick-witted and intelligent man. But what I get from you is that he never tolerated mediocrity.
Yeah, you know? There's a couple of paragraphs in this that are worth recalling.
From his former editor,
yeah. This is a great one. So he's talking about, on another occasion, a sports editor rang Hugh to find out how he was progressing. He replied gloomily, "I'm having trouble with the colon." When the desk man offered sympathy, asking if he was in pain, Hugh replied, "No, I mean, I can't decide if I need a colon or a semicolon in the sentence I'm struggling with." Or this, he was lively, even exuberant company, with a stock of funny stories from his past. The only exceptions were when he had discovered a grammatical or other mistake in his published story. Then a gloom would descend that alcohol served only to deepen. He once rang the office in the early hours to ask the night out to change late spring to early summer. The night editor's response is not recorded. So that gives you a sense of how much... Yeah. The words matter. How the words matter to him.
Yeah, Tommy Conlon hits on that, where he says those beautifully balanced sentences were wrought from hard labour over long hours. Constantly striving to be definitive was a torment from which he never escaped. There would have been a pressure on him.
Yeah,
to be Hugh McIlvany. Yeah. When he was 71, there typing away in 2005, there is a pressure when it's Hugh McIlvany and you're on the back page of the
absolutely.
Sunday Times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, you can't produce your best stuff for 50 years.
Yeah.
At all times.
I think he struggled to accept that, actually, you know. I guess we all would struggle to accept that, you know, our best is behind us. But I think Hugh in particular struggled with it. You know, I did find that.
You said at the end of your piece today, and the theme of your piece is the words mattered, that you asked him to sit down for an interview a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I called him actually. I called him about 2.5 years ago, just before he retired from the Sunday Times. I called him and I asked him would he sit down and talk to me and do an interview for our paper, it's on the Independent. And one of the things I said to him a couple of times over the years was, look, when are you going to, you have to sit down and write your book. Mm. You have to tell the story of your life in sport and your sports writing career. I mean, that would have been truly, truly worth reading. And he, for whatever reason, and I don't know what it is, I have a view on that and what it might be, but for whatever reason, he didn't want to do that. And I suspect it was the same reason he turned me down when I asked him would he sit down and talk about his life in sport. Now, at the time, he said, look, I'm not finished yet, and there was stuff he wanted to do, and I accepted that, but I kind of thought there was more. Mm. And I kind of, my view on it would be that, and this is not just particular to Hugh, but to a lot of people, I think he would be very comfortable holding the mirror up to Muhammad Ali and to great, but not as comfortable holding it to himself. Mm. I'm not sure he would have done that. I think that's the reason he never wrote that book, that great book. And actually, Michael Parkinson, in his piece in the Sunday Times today, makes the same point, you know, the great regret that he didn't actually go and write his autobiography, you know?
Yeah, Parkinson, so they've all the heavy hitters out in the Sunday Times. Sir Alex Ferguson with Jonathan Northcroft is a big piece, and I think Ferguson is very genuine in his admiration of McIlvenny and Michael Parkinson as well, where he did say that he said to him several times, you have to write your book, you know?
Ferguson walked him on his autobiography, yeah, he chose him for his autobiography.
It's the best, I mean, Ferguson's done a few books, not surprisingly, the best one by distance, and it was perfect timing in that it was published just after winning the treble, so it was kind of perfect.
Yeah.
But he talks in the piece with Northcroft as well about getting phone calls right across an 18-month period, and, you know, some nights he might ring me late into the night, is McClare with a big C or a small C? 3-4 times a day, you know? But Ferguson, you know, like, Ferguson sees the world, he just has a world view, and it's, you know, he's shaped in Govan, and he does talk about several Scottish people at that time. He says, Hugh came from the mining area, same as Jockstein, same as Shankly, same as, who's the Matt he's talking about? Oh, it must be Busby.
Busby, yeah.
Yeah, I was a bit different, I came from a shipbuilding area. But it is amazing the collective path all of us took. We all grew up, worked within 20, 30 miles of each other, industrial area of Scotland, producing exceptional people. Talked about how McIlvenny never went to college because he didn't do Latin at school. There was a breed of really clever, intelligent people who not only most of them were self-taught, but they also had to climb through the economic areas they came from. I always remember Jockstein saying to me about the mining area, when you're 300 feet below the earth, you don't know the man next to you, but that's the person that will save your life. That's what it's like working down a pit. It's quite a profound meaning. So you suspect that Scottishness was a big part of the reason Ferguson felt an affinity with McIlvenny.
And Graeme Souness then alludes to that as well, you know, that they ask Graeme for his contribution. But the Michael Parkinson one, and it strikes me about, you know, peers, you know, people can praise you left, right and centre, but until you get praise from your direct peers, you know, that's the ultimate accolade in any profession. So when Peter O'Sullivan was doing a book, he asked people to contribute to the book, and Michael Parkinson alludes to this book in his article. He says he showed the article to a colleague working on the charity project himself, a writer and broadcaster of talent and experience, who read the article and said it was one of the very best he'd ever encountered. As he handed the article back to Sir Peter, he said, "For God's sake, don't put that piece anywhere near my piece in the book. No man should be allowed to write as well as that." And that's very interesting.
Yeah, I had my first time to actually spend any time with him. My first time to notice him was in 1992 at the Barcelona Olympics. He was, when Michael Crute was fighting in the final, he was sitting a couple of seats, and I could hear him shouting at Crute, you know, punch him, hit him, you know.
Right.
Like, really engaged by Crute and rooting for Crute. So that was my first time to actually be in his company as such as a writer. I was only 2 years started at that stage. And then in 98, I went to Las Vegas the week before Wayne McCullough was fighting Nassim Hamed. And he was there. He was writing for the Sunday Times. Right. And we had dinner. We had dinner that night together. And, you know, I can't remember a single thing about the dinner. Not a single thing, except that he was drinking lovely wine and smoking a big cigar. Which is crazy at the time. I think I would have been just totally overawed. I know I certainly was overawed by the fact that we were both writing about Nassim Hamed that week. Mm. Like, to a degree that I actually couldn't write almost.
As in, I cannot be writing about this in the same newspaper as this guy. Yeah, I can imagine.
No, he was genius, definitely a genius. But again, of his time, for example, I mean, you can go through the archives. And I don't know if he has ever written a single word about doping in sport, doping in boxing, doping in racing, doping in anything. That was an area that, you know, he was never going to go in.
Mm. Why not?
I don't know whether it made him uncomfortable, whether his mind, the pictures, the portraits he created of people made a space for that kind of thing, you know? I'm not sure if that makes any sense. What I'm trying to say, I suppose, is, I mean, I don't know. For example, well, laterally when he went to the Open, it was always about Woods. He'd no time for the small guy hero who comes out and plays great this week.
There is a theme with his best stuff, i.e. George Best, Ali.
Yeah,
he's not so interested in the guy who's plodding away and finishing last. There's maybe a romance in that story other people are quite attracted to. He's gone for the genius.
He was the star writing about the star. He was interested in genius, and he wasn't interested in genius that came from pharmacy, you know, basically. Or okay. It was created by a pharmacy. That was a world he was unfamiliar with and wasn't particularly interested in visiting. And that's not a criticism, that's just a statement of fact. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was of his time and he was the best of his time without question.
Okay. Well, there's loads of coverage. The Ferguson piece, Northcroft puts a good story to him where he talks about McIlvany and Graeme Souness were debating at some dinner or other over whether or not Lionel Messi, Souness's choice, was greater than Maradona, who was McIlvany's.
Yeah.
And he says, an exasperated Souness, this is Jonathan Northcroft writing as part of the Ferguson piece, an exasperated Souness had to finally say, look, no one wants to have to do this. But he says, look, I played against Maradona 5 times and I'm telling you, it's Messi. Hugh growled back, I don't care who you played against, it's Diego. Told this one, I would side with Souness on that one, says Ferguson.
Yeah, but what does that tell you? See, that's interesting in itself. When I made that point about holding up the mirror. Mm. See, there's an example of that. I remember vividly in 1994 at the World Cup, he had this absolutely humongous row with Eamon Dunphy. You know, I don't know whether they were in the bar drinking together, but they had this absolutely incredible row. And I can just imagine what might have happened. Eamon would have expressed a view about a certain player or whatever. Hugh, of course, no, was real rubbish to. The two of them would have gone at each other like, you know, stags.
Okay.
You know, but again, in fairness, you're arguing with Graeme Souness, who's played against you
5 times.
You know. I mean, that suggests a certain arrogance, I don't know.
Well, Ferguson even says, well, look, I'm with Souness.
Yeah.
But then he says, though I can imagine Hugh's response, you don't effing know what you're talking about while blowing a big puff of smoke in your face.
Yeah.
I guess you need arrogance as well,
and
don't you?
The other quote was that when he was, again, defending Diego Maradona, one of the footballers was saying that you didn't play against Diego Maradona, how can you judge him? He said, I didn't write with Shakespeare either. But so he was, I imagine, I have never met him, but I'd say he was never boring to be around.
No.
No.
The piece in The Observer finally then on McIlvany is probably worth digging out if you actually want to read. It was the one place that reprinted something he'd written. So this was 1974, after Ali beat Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle. Like, in fairness though, he got to go to Ali's house for 2 hours after the fight.
Yes. It doesn't matter, Joe.
It's still absolutely
No, it doesn't matter. It's what
phenomenal.
You do with it.
No,
it's what
I
you
appreciate
do with it.
That. It's still
what
phenomenal.
You do with it.
But on Woods, it is then a pity in 05 that he spends no time with Woods. He has to sit in the house and eat your cooking You know, it's just a sign, of, you know, to Gary's point that the sport, the industry changed.
Yes, it did. It did. And it certainly, that wouldn't have worked. But he certainly got access to a lot of people, even laterally in his career. I mean, I remember him sitting down with Andy Murray for about, they got about 3 hours with Andy Murray at one stage. So no, he did. He was still the name.
Mm. This piece with Ali in 74 is absolutely phenomenal. Yeah. Just the words, every sentence is
But you
fantastic.
Could go back. I mean, I could give you 40, 50 of those pieces from sure. from that time and what he did.
Yeah.
That you would. There's Johnny Owen piece about the young Welsh boxer who died. It was just incredible.
That's the famous line about being articulate in the language of boxing.
Yeah.
Listen to us destroy one of the great quotes. But yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
So the quote is that outside the ring, he was inaudible and almost invisible personality. Inside, he became astonishingly positive and self-assured. He seemed to be more at home there than anywhere else. It is his tragedy that he found himself articulate in such a dangerous language. That's about Johnny Owen, who died in the ring. And Muhammad Ali's Rumble in the Jungle. We should have known that Muhammad Ali would not settle for any ordinary old resurrection. He had to have an astonishing flourish. So having rolled away the rock, he hit George Foreman over the head with it. Mm. So it's like the sentence is finished, reads beautifully, and then you just go another little bit and you just go, oh my God.
Yeah. That's the opening to this 74 piece, and on it goes and goes. He talked, he says of Ali sitting there, he talked with the quiet contentment of a man whose thoughts were acting on him as comfortingly as the hands of a good masseur. Just boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Every sentence is rock solid, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the kind of quieter moments in the house when you're chatting away with him?
Well, he held court, Hugh, you know.
Okay.
He held court. And I was more than happy to sit back and listen to him. I wasn't comfortable engaging with him because he could get quite nasty with drink on him, you know, and that's come across a lot of the pieces as well. He would get quite, I think he actually, it might have come to blows with Eamon back in the day. Eamon is a voice I actually wanted to hear on him. I think he'd have some interesting things to say. So I kind of kept him at a distance, so didn't get close to him, but was happy to listen to him because he certainly had plenty to say and interesting things to say. And again, an amazing life. One of the good things, one of the great things he's done since he's retired is a series on with Radio Scotland, BBC Radio, about his career. It's about 6 episodes of podcast. And I've seen that done. I'd say that's out because it wasn't just that he could write his voice then. He had the power of
a great voice.
Articulation was just superb. And his word power is phenomenal.
Yeah, okay. So that's McIlvenny, and there's coverage across the papers. Six Nations is everywhere as well. We're a week out.
Rest in peace. Okay.
Yeah. So Six Nations is everywhere, and there are pieces right across the papers. We're a week out. Gary, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I was in here last year at this time too for the Six Nations preview the week before, and we weren't as optimistic last year as we are this year. I think that the pieces that we've picked out, there are some nice pieces, starting with David Walsh's piece on Joe Schmidt, and Neil Francis has a piece on Joe Schmidt as well, but it's basically In Joe We Trust, and he's got this phenomenal way about him now, and the whole of the Irish supporting rugby public just are enamoured with this man. And the pieces today, do credit to the man and what he's done for Irish rugby. David Walsh has done a great piece. He's got Luke Fitzgerald, Mick Dawson, Owen Redden, Shane Jennings, Jamie Heaslip, all contributing to the piece. And it's a nice condensed piece about it, but it talks about when Joe Schmidt came into the Leinster camp, and they were doing Luke Fitzgerald regales this story about a video review on the Monday in Riverview after the game. And he says that Brian O'Driscoll had been thrown a pass, a very, very poor pass, to his bootlaces, which Brian knocked on. And the video analysis stopped and Joe turned around, and everyone else was expecting the guy who threw the pass to be told, you cannot throw a pass like that. And Joe Schmidt simply said to Brian, good players catch them. And that was it. And Brian has spoken a lot on in this parish about
you know, how he never felt that, he never knew what Joe was thinking about him, that he was always wanting to be better. And that day one, bang, there you go. Let's get the star of the team and tell him that he's not immune to criticism.
Well, he's the only coach to ever drop him.
Did he drop him?
He dropped him. He had O'Malley in. Okay. And then Owen got injured for a Leinster game. It was the first time Brian had ever been dropped. And the last, I think, actually, because Brian eventually actually played then.
Yeah.
Owen was injured and couldn't play in the game.
And Owen Redden alludes to that. He says he never took anything personal that Joe Schmidt did to him. I liked him when he picked me and I liked him when he didn't. And that's an extraordinary admission from a professional player that just wants to play the game all the time. And Shane Jennings, and you work with Shane and his analysis, but Shane Jennings alludes to the fact that one year they were playing in the final of the Amelin Cup against Stade Francais, and Joe Schmidt sat them all down, and they're feeling sorry for themselves. They're playing in the final of the Amelin, the Heineken Cup final is on the night after. They're the curtain raiser to the big event, and Joe Schmidt sits down and he says that these are three moves that I want to try in this game, and you've got to use these three moves. And he details the three moves. They do the three moves in the first half. They go in three tries up from the three moves that he's concocted for them. But one of the moves that Shane describes was a kick over the top. And when the ball went over the top, Andrew Conway, who was playing on the wing for Leinster that day, he had to jump in the air with his right knee in front, because the scrum half that would be covering that area of the ground wouldn't have the physical capacity to deal with Andrew's aggressive nature in the air. Mm. And to have analysed that, and it went exactly as he predicted. The ball went over the top, Andrew Conway caught it, leading with his right knee. The scrum half balked at the idea of having to have this take this guy, and they went on and scored a try. So this is Joe Schmidt, and he's been doing it for years and years and years. And last year, in the Six Nations, that inside pass from Tadhg Furlong, we all now presume that Joe has this magic wand that'll get us out of certain situations. Yeah. And it's going to be strange now next year coming to the Six Nations when Joe Schmidt is not around, And he says he's not going to have anything to do with rugby, and yet a friend is quoted in this David Walsh piece saying that he has three topics that he can talk about: rugby, rugby, rugby. And that the players used to try it amongst themselves to try and get him to talk about something that wasn't rugby, and the record was 5 minutes before he turned
into rugby. Yeah, he won't like that anecdote sneaking out. He runs a tight ship.
No, he won't.
He won't like reading that.
It's not named, actually.
No.
It's a friend.
Yeah, it's a friend.
It's a friend. And maybe we should. I'd be afraid now that Joe will be upset and that we'll ruin the aura for him. But it's just, it's there. That's what they say about him. And there has to be this, he runs a very tight ship, obviously. And then on the flip page of the David Walsh pieces, Dennis Walsh's.
Are you going to let me talk about Joe Schmidt?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
So I was the first thing I read across any of the papers, this Schmidt piece, because I am absolutely fascinated by this guy.
I know he would fascinate you.
Fascinated by him. And I thought it's a great piece of journalism because he goes out and looks for, five, six different opinions on Schmidt. And that story about the what he talks about was perfect. I mean, that sums up what he's like. That the guy's taking a bet. How long can I get him? Will it be before he goes back talking about rugby? I think it was a record 5 minutes.
A little over 5 minutes stands as the record. Yeah.
But the intro to this is just brilliant. So David quotes the routine of Ristad Cooper when he's taking on Joe Schmidt. First, he is boyish and smiling. Yeah, we'll do our best, and that's not good enough. We'll take it on the chin and move on. People make mistakes, and then you accept that. Then there's the pause before Cooper tells his audience about the significance of the name Schmidt. In a moment, he transforms into Joseph Schmidt, leader of the Gestapo. If anyone drops a concedes a pass, they will be eliminated. Everyone laughs because they sense the comedian touches on the truth. And that's it. That's what makes him so interesting. The iron fist in the velvet glove.
Walsh writes as well, Schmidt has heard that gag live and tells the comedian he finds it funny. Cooper's not so sure.
Yeah. I mean, he is an absolute control freak. He controls everything.
There has been no coach in Irish sport, including Charlton, who has just been so universally praised, admired, right to the very end. You can almost say, regardless of how the World Cup goes, nobody wants to see this guy leave. After, 2013 with Ireland and a few years before at Leinster, it's close to unheard of for someone to have this level of success. And the approval rating, I would say, is 99%?
Well, look what he's done, it's not a surprise.
That's phenomenal.
You look what he's done with the team, the way he's transformed the team. It's not a surprise. And the praise justified. He's the best out there.
And yet he hasn't rested on his laurels at all. Mm. With no disrespect to Jack Charlton, he's not one for picking up his fishing license and rod going down west of Ireland and paying by check, so the check is never cashed because it's signed by Joe Schmidt.
The most surprising thing in this piece was that apparently he used to golf every Wednesday at Claremont.
And then stopped.
When he joined Leinster.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Joe Schmidt going golfing for a day.
Yeah.
Shane, not every Wednesday anyway.
So again, I'm always drawn to the dark side. Shane Jennings quote, Joe's not perfect and at times he's not nice to be around because he will call people out. I mean, I'd love to see him in that time when he's not nice to be around. I'd love to actually witness that and say that's fascinating.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the anecdote about Brian on the first day, and that Owen Redden could be dropped by him and still like him. I mean, he has made very hard decisions, and not been afraid to take those hard decisions. But they obviously have a tremendous amount of trust in him. And when something like that comes off, when he predicts that this move will work in certain situations and it comes off, and then he goes to them the next time, you have to be quite certain that if he says, Joe Molloy, you can do anything you want, and I know that because, look, I've proved this time and time again, it must instill a huge amount of confidence. And pieces have been written on them that Ireland go in 8 points down at half time, and people in the crowd are just 8 points. No, Joe will sort that out.
They'll
at
do
half
something.
Time.
Yeah,
I haven't heard that. You spent a lot of time with Brian in here, Joe. Does he ever talk about? I haven't heard people actually talk about Schmidt's motivation, ability to motivate, or his halftime speeches, or any of that stuff. Like, you get all the coaching stuff and the preparation and all that, he's meticulous about that. But in terms of being an orator or his ability to motivate on a one-to-one basis or a collective basis, I haven't heard...
It's never something I've heard any of them go to first.
Is that, yeah. Isn't that interesting in itself? Mm. It's almost as if that doesn't matter.
It does feel like, you suspect Schmidt might think it's of a bygone era.
Yeah. Yeah, this is how it's done. This is the way. Yeah.
If you need motivation, I'll just put in one of the other six players who can play in your position. It seems to be the general
motivation
air.
Enough is to lose your place. Yeah.
But, I mean, the Brian O'Driscoll example is very interesting.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So you're clearly the best player here. I'm going to keep you on your toes. Yeah. It would be interesting to see how he treats someone who's a bit less secure.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that was intended, to keep Brian on his toes. I think I read from that it was just fact. You want to be the best in the world, you got to be picking those passes up. Mm. Simple fact. Mm. But, it wasn't...
O'Driscoll said he always wondered it. It wasn't like they got past that initial period and then he knew he really had Schmidt's confidence.
Sure.
So it was almost a consistent.
Yeah. That's kind of frightening.
It is. I do feel sorry for Mervyn Murphy in this.
Yeah.
In 2013, Schmidt got the job. So Mervyn Murphy had a nice life. Mervyn Murphy was happy. He did 3-minute videos on the 6 or 7 key players in the opposition for every test.
Yeah.
Manageable. That was what it was like under Kidney. Schmidt said that would have to change. He wanted video clips of the 23 players likely to make the matchday squad, which meant he had to produce around 30 videos for every game. Each video took hours to put together. He says, though, no one grumbled because Schmidt worked harder than anyone. But that is a serious workload. It is the reason why come Paddy's weekend in March, they all just look wiped. All the coaching staff. Yeah. They're working all hours during the Six Nations.
Yeah.
What else on the rugby front grabbed you?
Because we've got one of the greatest fans here, rugby fans, we might as well go through the predictions. You're interested in the predictions, aren't you?
No.
Okay, do you want them?
Yeah,
okay. So, predictions. Clive Woodwork from the Mail. England, Ireland, Wales, France, Scotland, Italy, in that order. Steve Jones in the Sunday Times. Ireland, Wales, England, Scotland, France, Italy, in that order. Brendan Fanning in the Sunday Independent. Ireland, England, Wales, Scotland, France, Italy, in that order. And Ian McGeechan, he doesn't actually list them, but you can get his order from reading his analysis. Wales, Ireland, England, Scotland, France, Italy.
Yeah, and I think it is extremely tight. But I think going into this Six Nations competition, I think that for the first time that I can ever recall as a fan, I'm not actually looking to this, I'm looking to October.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And I want to see, you know, something that will happen here that you can build to October. And that's, there are a few things that you want to see happen in this Six Nations. You'd like to see a reserve hooker perform extremely well. You want to see some rotation in the back row and second row. You want to see Joey Carberry get some experience playing at 10 in on the big occasion. And I think it's more about that than whether Ireland finished top. But you'd have to presume if they perform to their the level that they can.
I mean, I'm for instant gratification. Let's win the Six Nations again. Then we worry about the World Cup.
I would rather finish third in the Six Nations, even if it was to England and Wales who are ahead of us, and make a World Cup semi-final. Mm. And from the World Cup semi-final then, I'm not one of these people that anything can happen. Something will happen, because that's in Joe we trust, you know. Mm. So I think that this, for the first time, I think it's not all about this Six Nations or Grand Slam. We won that last year. We want to see something different.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not giving him a free pass on this. I'm just saying that that's the way I feel about it. And
that's not the way he's...
He has earned that. I think that Joe Schmidt has earned the right to say, look,
but
he's had awful
that.
Six Nations in the past. There's been some terrible Six Nations. He won't see it like that.
No.
But that's great. That's why I'm so happy to think like this, because I know that's the last thing he's thinking like.
Well, he made the point during the week, a really bad one has the power to destabilise things ahead of a World Cup. Mm. Why mess with the momentum? It's not like we've that many games. So,
yeah.
But that's not to say you won't experiment a touch.
There's very interesting pieces, you know, comparing the, you know, the Maro Itoje of the English team to the James Ryan of the Irish team. I think that's all kind of fascinating stuff, and that's going to play out over the next 6 or 7 weeks. But... And the Sexton Farrell thing, that's always dredged up. But I'm more interested in, you know, an Irish team coming through and, you know, playing for each other, expanding that 23 to 30, a pool of 30 that are hugely competitive for all the places. And I don't think we're quite there yet.
If you're looking for different angles and things, there's good governance and bad governance. As in, Brendan Fanning is talking about the governance of the Six Nations, and it doesn't make for good reading at all. So the potted history here is, in 2016, RBS said they no longer would be supporting the Six Nations. He's just talking about the finances off the pitch here. And they've been sponsors since 2003. And what they proposed was, going forward, 13.75 million a year for the next 4 years. And John Feehan and the RBS... or sorry, John Feehan and the Six Nations board looked at this and they got a valuation done, and the valuation told them 13.75 million a year for the next four seasons was towards the higher end, but they thought they could do better and they told RBS as much. And we're at a point now where they've gone out into the market. HSBC, we're knocking around for a while, that's gone. 6 weeks ago, Guinness were announced as the partner, and their deal is for 8.5 million a year, 5 million a year less than what RBS offered originally for 6 years, beginning with this season's tournament. So Guinness have had a bit of a steal here. And he says the council comprises of CEOs from the Six Nations, countries' representatives in World Rugby, 12 men around the table arguing the toss of how much the cash cow can be milked. And he says everyone has an agenda, everyone has a horse to trade in these circumstances. It's easy enough to see how someone could declare a pretty good deal to be a crock. And it seems that's happened here and cost them a huge amount of money. And equally with the EPCR and the Heineken Champions Cup, as it's called now. So for a long time, Heineken paid 10 million a year and they decided to redo things. They reckoned they could get five different sponsors paying 4 million each year and so come in with 20 million. And Fanning writes, would you believe it never happened? Heineken came back on board as the sole sponsor for 4 million less than they'd been paying in the first place. Great business there, lads. So they've gone from 10 million a year from Heineken down to 6 million in the Champions Cup. And the Six Nations, they've gone from 13.75 million a year offer from RBS down to 5 million less from Guinness for the next 6 years. Mm. It's extraordinary they're making that much of a mess of things when, especially in the Six Nations, it's never been more popular.
Yeah.
but it's popular amongst the fans. It's obviously not popular amongst the businesses who want to put their money out there.
I don't know. It's curious, though, isn't it?
It looks like a shockingly bad decision.
It is curious. I mean, it's
greed. It's pure greed. Here, I'll give you this on the table, or you can take your chances out there. And they've taken their chances, and they just got too greedy.
That's the word. Yeah.
But it's a good piece. I think a lot of people wouldn't be aware of a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then Eamon Sweeney's writing about Philip Brown, who has been at the RFU for a very long time now, and is basically saying a success story almost too good to be true is the headline, and lists off the good and the bad. It's mainly good, you would have to say. The RFU was once on a par with the FAI as a subject for derision concerning its perceived administrative shortcomings. Its much derided blazers were a byword for amiable, amateurish bungling. Whereas he says, IRFU now have a reputation for omnicompetence. They're a sporting body held up to others as to how to do things, and lists off the many decisions they've done, and basically said they pretty much have all been right. Maybe getting rid of Connacht in 03, he talks about, as being a big mistake. Doesn't mention the Grobler situation. I'm sure they'd like that decision back. But on the whole, in this World Cup year, he's making the point that they've turned this whole organisation around, and that it seemed unlikely that a 37-year-old Dubliner, which is what Brown was, with a doctorate in geography at the time, whose sporting background was in rowing, was going to be one of those who would spearhead the change.
Yeah, that's a good piece.
He's done it. Yeah.
It's a very good piece by Eamon. And you would have thought from an outsider looking in that Philip was lucky. You know, he just happened to have a talented player like, firstly, Brian O'Driscoll that was leading the team through. Then, aren't we so lucky that then we got Paul O'Connell, and then you're so lucky and this can't keep up. But yet it has, it's got momentum now, and the whole organisation is something that I'm sure Philip looks at his position now and he says, yeah, I'm proud that I've done that over the years. But Eamon does say at the end, for the moment, they've never had it so good. Philip Brown is the monarch of all he surveys. Irish rugby is the behemoth of Irish sport, favoured to win two Grand Slams in a row for the first time ever. Looking forward to a World Cup, which is the most eagerly awaited and will be the most followed sporting event in Ireland this year. In a country where the response to good weather is to A, wonder when it'll break, and B, worry about the consequences of a rain shortage, this staggering success story almost seems too good to be true. And we're really guilty of that, you know, that we're looking here, you know, at Irish rugby saying, this has got to crash someday, and there's no reason for it to crash. You know, we can keep this going. Ireland can keep this going. There's enough talent coming through. And the person we've alluded to earlier on, Mr. Schmidt, when he exits stage left and we have to get on without him, hopefully Mr. Farrell will step in and do the same thing for us for the next
Schmidt going is the real litmus test. If they survive that, then there's decades of good times ahead. The structures really are in place.
Yeah.
Was there any other rugby pieces? There was a few. Neil Francis got a mention in the meeting room briefly.
Can I say something before the Neil Francis piece that Paul wants to speak on? The Neil Francis piece comes with the picture. And there aren't very many better pictures in the Sunday newspapers today of that. And then you can tell that that's Joe Schmidt. And it's just a great picture, but no byline on the picture. And I think that's tremendously sad that someone has taken such a good picture, the paper use it, and don't put their byline on it. Now, you want to talk about Frano.
Neil Francis.
For people on the radio, by the way, the picture is the profile of Joe Schmidt. The light is behind him. You can't see his face. So you just recognise the profile anywhere. So that's the picture for people who didn't see it.
So if you look at Neil's piece, if you take it, you take the last third of it, with the paragraph that starts, if we look at the scale of success and the pitch where the national side are at the moment, outside of Joe Schmidt's influence, the Heineken Cup was the biggest single factor in dragging rugby union in this country into a hugely supported sport with mass appeal. Now, if you read the piece from there to the end, it's quite good and makes some very good points, very coherent points. Now, if you start at the very start, as I did, and most people will, you will check the byline immediately to see if it wasn't written by Ross O'Carroll Kelly, because a lot of it is really objectionable and absolute rubbish. My daughter Evelyn was on holidays with us a couple of years ago in Portugal, and she got chatting to a group of boys, and they were asking her where she was from and what school she goes to. Now, these were rugby lads, Southsiders, and for some reason that seems to matter a huge amount to these people, what school you go to and where you're from. And when Evelyn told this fellow in particular that she'd gone to school in Loretto in Balbriggan, his response was, "Mummy wouldn't approve." Okay, now what this piece smacks of is "Mummy wouldn't approve," and that class bullshit that a lot of people in this country just cannot avoid. As an example, the piece starts with Neil going to a West Ham game. I'm not sure when this was, obviously a couple of years ago. And he comes out of the game and...
Late 80s,
and they're killing each other. And he's in the tube station down Green Street. And he's lucky to get out there without getting stabbed, basically. Now, I'm not sure what the point of that is, except that, making a point that, you know, these football fans are a different class. Now, listen, West Ham fans are a different class than any of them and Millwall. But anyway, I'm not quite sure where he's going. Well, we get a sense of it then when he introduces us to Declan Rice at West Ham. Every week I see all of our national newspapers give acres of room to this young boy called Declan Rice of West Ham, a peripheral figure to most people on this island, but to some it seems like he's the Messiah. The boy Rice was born in Kingston upon Thames. Anyway, he gives a sense of Rice and where he's from and the fact that he's been encouraged to throw his allegiance in with the national team. And Jesus, I don't know what it's about, you know. Imagine the scene when the boy Rice, after numerous unanswered calls from Mick McCarthy and Robbie Keane, gets a call from his mother. There is a gruff man from Crumlin and an even gruffer man from Barnsley, and they want to talk to you about playing for, you know, the island of Erin. Now, what is this? What is he saying here? This is rugby country. We are a superior class. These football gurriers, you know.
I think it leads on from an argument that Neil has been having about the national sport. And I think it's ridiculous. I think it's ridiculous to try and compare the two sports. And at a time when Neil was at his peak in sport and his prowess was at his, you know, magnificent, I was competing as well, and I had this chip on my shoulder about the soccer team too. I didn't like the soccer team. I thought that they were vulture-like in their extraction of any kind of sponsorship that lay around Ireland. And I can understand this, but I've grown up now. I'm over it. But to the Ross O'Carroll-Kelly thing, that's a little bit cruel. But
well, It's not cruel at all. Let me give you a prime example why it's not cruel. Declan Rice is the boy Rice. Who else? There's another boy in here somewhere. There's another footballer he calls the boy. But Jacob Stockdale is not the boy Stockdale. He's Jacob Stockdale. Now, that is straight out of Ross O'Carroll-Kelly. I'm sorry.
Just to lighten it a little bit for the moment, can I wish Pres Bray, my old alma mater, who are playing in the Leinster School Senior Cup tomorrow, the best of luck. And I won't mention the school that they're playing against because I'd be fearful that I'd have a backlash. And the school that they're playing against, I wish them good luck, but not as much luck as I wish.
Oh yeah, sorry. Here it is. The other boy is the boy Jack Grealish. The FEI humiliated themselves over the boy Jack Grealish, and to compound that error, they have spent the last year trying to tempt another English boy into playing for Ireland. Grealish has already declared for England, and Rice will assuredly do the same. Both knowing they will never even get close to the England squad. In this instance, this is not about the better offer or the more attractive prospect. It is about avoiding the least attractive offer, the prospect of playing for the Republic of Ireland. It is patently obvious that neither has any real interest in playing in green, and the Irish governing body begging them to reconsider could only be considered a humiliation if it had any sense of self-worth. Well, I'm sorry.
Some people would agree with that.
Well, some people, okay, well, he's not in a great position to agree with it, given we've got a South African and a Samoan.
I was just going to say.
Playing for the great rugby team.
Yeah, the rugby team do the same thing. But people would agree that going begging to Declan Rice is the wrong thing to do. Now, begging is the wrong word to use. I don't think they are.
Yeah.
they've certainly left the door open for him.
Sure.
He's a decline of Irish soccer contrasts markedly with the rise of pro rugby. That's, I mean, his overall point, because it's probably hard when people haven't read it, is that there was a time in the 90s when rugby was the correlation, and now he says it's totally spun around and football's the correlation and rugby has never been better. That's the overall point he's making.
But my point to counteract Neil's point in his piece is that the Irish soccer team are always on the verge of or do qualify for the major tournaments. And if the Irish soccer team qualify for the Euros, the whole country again will get behind them. And it's not going to be the same if Ireland, the Irish rugby team, make the semi-final of the World Cup. You won't see that same euphoria that we witnessed before. Now, it's different times and people express themselves differently. Rather than going into O'Connell Street and waving a flag, you just tweet. So it's a different thing. But I think because of the fact that you cover all sports and both sports, I think that how you get riled up by this won't rile up the people that pick up the paper every week to read Neil Francis. That is fodder for them, and they will read this and they'll kind of nod and they won't pay much attention. They won't get angered in the same way as you get angered. If you're a soccer loving person and you pick up Neil Francis, Declan Lynch should be at home there going, and I'm sure he'd be annoyed that Frana is saying stuff like this. But you're different. I can read this piece and just, you know,
players on the national side are very visible and comport themselves, this is the rugby players, and comport themselves in a humble and down-to-earth fashion. They are polite, articulate and engaging, characteristics which not only have gone out unnoticed in the general population, but also by corporate Ireland. We would like to allow our products and our services with these particular athletes and this particular sports. Winners winning is everything. Winning with style and grace is the cherry on top.
I absolutely agree with you that is an unfair thing to say, that because I have encountered an awful lot of the Irish soccer team and they are superb professionals. Mm. They are wonderful people. Right. They behave in the exact same way, but they just aren't as public in because they're not here. They don't live in Dublin. And nor could they. They cannot eke out a living here in Dublin. They eke out their living over in the UK. I have to say, the most impressive sportsman I've met in the most recent years is Seamus Coleman. And you won't get a more impressive person. You could look all over the world. He's a singularly most impressive man that I met in difficult circumstances, and he carried himself with the graciousness that you would expect. And it's unfair of Frano to say that the soccer players don't do that. I've met plenty of rugby players who are equally as impressive, but they're all impressive. I think Frano needs to go and meet this Irish, the Irish team and find out.
Why can we not celebrate the rugby team? Why is it not enough to celebrate the rugby team without saying we're the greatest, we're number one now?
I don't know is the honest answer. And I think it comes from the years, and I've said it myself, I just said it, that I had a chip on my shoulder about the soccer team during the 90s as well. I didn't like them, I gave my reasons for not liking them. But now I've gotten over it, and maybe this is going to be cathartic for Neil, that he will now say, okay, maybe I should let this go.
We don't have time to do all the pieces. You mentioned Sergio Parisse's lost 100 test match, which is something in itself. Ronan O'Gara is in the main section of the Sunday Independent. The French had a different attitude to cheating, Rog, is the quote. He's with Donald Lynch here. It's worth a look. It covers various different bits and pieces. One line kind of stood out, I guess, given the discussion about rugby in recent years. There's cheats in every sport, and there's definitely cheats in rugby. But he says it's so hard when you're training the house down naturally, trying to make gains in the gym, and then you hear of a teammate or someone you're playing taking something, it would disgust you. And you presume he's talking hypothetically about teammates there, because he goes on to talk about how his teammates, you would have been a pariah if you had done anything like that, but probably is worth clarification. He says, when I was coaching in France, I was suddenly exposed to people from different cultures, realised some people had different attitudes to those things. generation I grew up in would have all been about the shame you would bring on your family if you were tempted. You'd feel you would ostracize your family from the parish, and that's a good way to feel. I don't think everyone had that. Okay, he says, I don't think everyone had that. Yeah, you'd probably like that to be teased out a little bit more. It just hangs in the air a bit. He also talks about
Joe, you're going to be sitting opposite now for the best part of 6 weeks, are you?
Yeah. It's not something I intend to do in a 3-minute conversation.
No, listen, you've got responsibilities now, you know, to hold them to that and to hold them to account. And I'm sure all of your, I certainly know you'll have one viewer who'll be really interested.
I look forward to turning on my phone after each show and checking the text messages. He talks as well, though, about the size in rugby, you know, like what do we do? Because we've talked about concussion and there have been deaths in rugby recently as well. He says you couldn't limit it. A better way would be to tell players that bigger isn't always better. Keith Earls has stripped down and become lighter, more agile. He's a key person for Ireland, so that's an interesting point to make as well. It's kind of a general interview. It's less sporty. He's talking about his career generally, but the cheating line kind of jumped out. It'd be worth the clarification. Any last points anyone wants to make on the rugby?
Yeah.
Well, we can clarify it one way or another.
Yeah.
Who wants any last points on the rugby you want to make, or we move on? Because there are other bits and bobs in the papers.
No, just like I said, the best of luck to Presbury tomorrow. Did I say that?
You did several times. Okay. Yeah. We'll take a break. There's loads more to get to. There's a really interesting interview with Gareth Farrelly in the Sunday Times. There are some GAA pieces. Joe Brawley on St Enda's. Ryan Wiley with Mark Gallagher. Dermot Gleese is writing about Conor Purcell. So we'll get to them in just a second.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, welcome back. We're here with Gary O'Toole and Paul Kimmage looking through the Sunday papers. There's an interview on page 4 of the Sunday Times. Paul Rowan has sat down with Gareth Farrelly, a former footballer, now a lawyer, who was in the news headlines a couple of months ago when he came forward with accusations of bullying at Aston Villa. So he's done an interview with Paul Rowan here. You picked this one out, Paul. You like this?
Yeah, I really liked it. Really, really interesting. Paul's done two very good pieces today. The Farrelly piece on the left, and then he's got a column on scouts, some of the English scouts that are the scouts the FAI employ in England to find players are being cut back. But the Farrelly piece is really, really interesting because, as you said, Joe, he's been in the news recently with regard to that alleged bullying case at Aston Villa, and the fact that he was one of the former players there who made a complaint about Kevin McDonald. Kevin McDonald was the assistant manager under Steve Staunton, or a coach under Steve Staunton, when Stephen had the Irish job. And one of the points that Farrelly made about that and why he was really incensed when McDonald was brought into the Ireland camp was that he says, Farrelly says that when he was at Villa and Farrelly was getting capped by Ireland, that McDonald would demean him and say, well, they're only Mickey Mouse caps, basically, because the Irish are Mickey Mouse caps. And that really annoyed him. But what is interesting about him now is, and I don't know whether...
Just to be clear on that one, by the way, before we leave it, there is an ongoing investigation.
It's an ongoing investigation.
That is very much a claim, and McDonald may very well deny that took place. And he's had support from other players who said there were no issues, and equally, Farrelly has its support from other players who said there were issues. So that's an ongoing investigation at the moment as things stand, just to be very clear on that point.
So Gareth was very, very talented player, played at Villa, Everton, Bolton, Wigan, and then at 28, he was given the chance to manage Bohemians. And that was interesting because during the course of my interview with Steve and Kenny last week, Farrelly came up. Because when he was managing Bohemians, he fairly succeeded him as manager of Bohemians. But when I was talking to Stephen about his time at Bohemians, they were on this great cup run. The board wanted to bring Farrelly in for a couple of games during that European run.
Yeah.
That they were having, there was some provision there that they could have brought him in and played him a couple of games. And Stephen Kenny was absolutely adamant. He was absolutely not going to do that. He was not going to bring Farrelly in to display someone who had been playing for him and loyal to him for the whole season, just for the, you know. So he wouldn't do it. So they sacked him and they brought Farrelly in then as the player manager. Yeah.
Okay, ruthless.
Yeah.
He's had a tough time, but personally as well in that.
Farrelly.
He was very, very ill.
No, so he managed Bowes, then he went to Cork City. And he just left, obviously, Wigan. And there was a clause at the time, FIFA had a clause that you could not play for three clubs in the same season. They blocked him playing for Cork City. Then in 2008, he got seriously ill. He had a stomach tumour. I think 20% of his stomach removed, 40%
of his pancreas
removed.
His entire spleen.
His entire spleen. So got really, really ill. And then was chased by the revenue in England for some of these tax avoidance schemes that the footballers get drawn into. Mm. And obviously had had a lot of trouble there. But what he did, and we were speaking about this on the way in, Gary, was, I'm not sure what the context of what, or what provoked it. It might actually have been him. We were talking about, you know, what's wrong with these guys, or, you know, they can't. So I said to you, I said, well, look, you're a consultant. Okay, Gary, sorry, you're losing your job. What are you going to do? You're no longer a consultant. What are you going to do?
I think the context was that we were discussing punditry, mm-hmm. you know, and that do people fall into punditry or do they actually have designs on being pundits? Because you can get very lazy as a pundit. You know, you can just rock up and not have done the research, not have. And I was faced with that personally in 2012 when RTÉ were covering the Olympics, and they rang me and said, would you do this swimming coverage for the Olympic Games? And I said, you know what? I wouldn't be your best bet. There are better people out there that would be more familiar with these swimmers than I would be, and you're better off going after them, actually. And I took a step back from the punditry, and I could have gone on the internet and done the research, but I would have been learning names. I wouldn't have known mm-hmm. the ins and the outs of it. I wouldn't have known family members or how they had performed in Berlin the previous the year before, the kind of stuff that you still see with the likes of Gerry Kiernan. And when Gerry speaks about athletics, he will know their last golden mile results and everything. So I was gone beyond that, and our point was that, you know, that a lot of these sports people see punditry as you know, I'll just do the punditry and keep it ticking over, and it the public deserve better than that. And this is how this came up. Was
my point was, well, what else are they going to do?
Yeah, what would I do?
How do you reinvent yourself after you spent, you know, and the point I made about you, you've invested your whole life in your work and in becoming what you are today, an eminent consultant. What happens if that's taken away from you? You can't go, you're going to retrain. How are you going to reinvent yourself? So not easy.
Not easy. And this is what Garrett did.
This is what he did. He went and he trained as a solicitor and now works as a qualified solicitor for a law firm in Liverpool, which is really fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
He makes some interesting points. Like, he's not a great fan of Kenny's. You certainly get the impression reading this, he's not a great fan of Kenny's and would have reservations about the fact that he's getting the job now after Mick. He says the remit will be to bed him in with the Ireland under 21, so hopefully not have the issue where senior players may not respond or respect him or whatever. He is confident of that happening, but nobody can predict or envisage how that will go. This is Farrelly talking about Stephen, you know. I'm making a point that I touched on with Stephen when last week in that interview about, you know, getting the respect, inverted commas, of the kind of players who aren't aware of him. Mm-hmm. And what he's done in the League of Ireland.
I think Garrett alludes to in the first couple of paragraphs about himself being, he knows that when he was playing, he could have been a little bit difficult, and I think it comes down to just, speaking his mind. Yeah. And this is what comes across in this article as well. He has reinvented himself. He calls a spade a spade. And they can be difficult people to deal with in life, you know, that the people that aren't, that don't have a filter, you know. That
you're looking at me.
I'm just explaining something quite simply, that they don't have something that it clicks into the brain that this could make life difficult for me going down the road. And that's what I get the impression from this piece, that Garrett is one of those people that he's been through so much. He's had a life-altering experience with medicine and the operation that he underwent. He's a solicitor now, and if I was someone who needed a solicitor, he'd be the kind of solicitor I'd like on my side rather than trying to battle against.
You spent a lot of time with Stephen Kenny for that piece last week. What were your impressions of him?
Not what I expected for a start. That was a real surprise. I kind of expected a kind of mini Brian Kerr, someone who would sit down and regale you with fantastic stories, and so very reserved.
You might have had that wrong then from afar.
Oh, I definitely had it wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I did, because I listened to the review and you had Shane. Yeah, he put me right on that straight away. No, I did. I definitely got that wrong. And I should have known better because I'd listened, obviously, to his interview with Eamon and to Marion Finucane in particular.
You thought they were the exception.
I did. Yeah. I did. Particularly the Marion Finucane one was just shocking. So I was definitely surprised by that. You know, I was delighted he got the job. I was delighted he got the chance. I think he's had a fantastic career. I think he deserves the chance. So we spent 5 hours together, and I was totally engaged by him. Like really engaged by him.
And that's interesting because I wasn't. I got the impression you were more frustrated than engaged.
No, I did. Well, I had to work. Yeah. I had to work. Like, he really made me work. But the point I'd make is that when I'm sitting there with anybody, everybody starts with that. Blank page. There you go. So blank page. So you start telling me stuff, then great. But if you don't start telling me stuff, I have to go looking for it and I have to start digging for it. But the digging in itself tells you something about the person mm-hmm. you're dealing with. So he was cautious, thoughtful. Mm. And what really surprised me was that I thought having spent time with him, whenever I spent time with anyone, for example, when I used the Murray example. When I interviewed Murray, he was 19 before Roland Garros there a good few years ago. I knew coming away, I said, this kid is going to win a Grand Slam. This kid will win a Slam event. Mm-hmm. No, I was no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. I just got a real sense. So you always get a sense, or often get a sense, of people that you interview. What is the gift? What do they have? I couldn't find that with Stephen. I don't know what it is. I know it's something. I couldn't put my finger on it.
He didn't want to let you see it, maybe.
He didn't want to let me see it, probably, yeah. Yeah. Okay. But it was interesting.
Yeah.
And I really, I think he's a tremendous guy. Truly a tremendous guy. Yeah, a lot of admiration for him. And hope he does well.
Okay. Very quickly then, because we've got to kind of wrap this up quite quickly. I don't think we'll have time to get into everything. So take your pick between Ryan Wiley or Joe Brawley on St. Enda's. Equally, Dermot Cleese writing about Conor Purcell is worth a look as well, just to touch on those as we begin to wrap up.
Yeah, I had no idea Conor Purcell was Joey Purcell's son, which is really interesting, and that he was such a gifted tennis player. He was 12-year-old, he was the best tennis player in Ireland at 12, Conor. So he's obviously one of these really
talented, yeah.
Talented kids.
It's funny, I went out and Googled him. I wasn't aware of him, to be honest, too much either, but he did talk about as a young tennis player, Ireland's best at his age, playing one of the better kids in England and losing 6-love, 6-love, and almost in a crushing way realising just how impossible the tennis dream was.
So obviously the goal
still he was, I mean, look, he's the best tennis player in Ireland for his age. Yeah. He's pretty gifted.
But to go and do what he did, so that was a lovely piece that Dermot did with him. To go and win the Australian Amateur was a fantastic achievement, and you know, completed what was a great weekend for Irish golf, with Shane Lowry winning over in Abu Dhabi, and then the unification of the ladies and the golfing union.
Yeah, his father is, as you said, Joey, who was the Portmarnock head pro from 1991,
yeah,
up until very recently. So yeah, a lot of people would have come across him over the years. Do you know what I really liked about this piece? So his son is up and coming, and he spent some time, courtesy of your good friends at Nike, Paul, with Tiger Woods.
Yeah, that was great.
And Woods, the piece opens with Woods looking at Purcell, who's recently won this big tournament in Australia, amateur tournament, where he says to Joe LaCava, this kid gets in a good slot, doesn't he? But what I really, like, so his father was obviously a really, really good player, played in tournaments with the likes of Faldo and Norman and Lyle and Des Smith, the Spanish Open he finished eighth in before he took up his position at Portmarnock. But he is just so unequivocal about the fact that his son is better than him.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that can be a difficult thing for a talented parent, to watch a son or daughter surpass them. And maybe there's a little bit of jealousy or just...
Do you think so?
I think it goes on a little bit.
I don't know. What do you think?
Hang on. He said, I was a decent enough player from my time. Mm. But when people ask me if I was as good as Conor at his age, my reply is, I was never as good as Conor. Never. Just it's a very nice, supportive way to be about it, and not even to be, well, you know, maybe I, you know, in my day I could do a bit. He is I don't know, it just struck me as a nice way to very gracious way to treat your son who's trying to find his way in a really tough sport. His prize for winning this amateur event, by the way, he's going to play in a European Tour co-sanctioned event. So I presume he'll turn pro eventually, but it's a good piece. There's a nice picture of them in the back garden with the AstroTurf putting green.
Yeah.
Conor Purcell and the two parents behind him.
And interesting, Neil Manship has coached the both of him and Shane, so that was a good weekend, good weekend for Neil. But then, again, Dermot, you know, we spoke about Michael Vanney. I hope God forbid that ever when the day comes that we'll speak as glowingly about Dermot, because again, he's a colossus of Irish journalism. And you know, there are examples of what makes him great all over this piece. You know, the fact that he could tell you that, you know, about Joey, and that, you know, he tied eight in the Spanish Open and earned £766. Significantly, among those tied with him were such luminaries as Nick Faldo, Greg Norman, Sandy Lyle, and Des Smith.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as if this fellow was a dud.
No, that's what I mean. So he's very gracious to say this. Yeah. My kid's way better than me.
Yeah.
Not just when I was his age, just at my very best, at my peak, he's still better than me. I just thought it was a lovely, gracious thing to do. You know.
So I liked Dermot's piece. I liked that piece by Mark Gallagher on
Ryan Wiley.
Ryan Wiley. Yeah. He's a radiologist at the Mara Hospital. He lives literally in the shadow of Croke Park. And when Monaghan are playing there, he's got to get in his car.
I can't believe this.
Drive down to Monaghan and then come back up with the team.
Now that's the process gone mad, isn't it?
That is the process gone absolutely insane.
So he says the worst game for him is when Monaghan have to play in Croke Park. Yeah. He has to drive from his house and then turn around and come back.
Back down to Joe Park.
Interesting that he's in the paper today, because obviously the National League starts and they're playing Dublin today, and you know, on the day of a game that they haven't subscribed to this nonsense of you know, media bans and not talking to journalists. So that in itself was noteworthy.
Mm. The Joe Brawley piece. So he's out and about going to see club matches. St Enda's in North Belfast. I presume that this is very well known. I just wasn't as familiar with St Enda's in North Belfast. They played on Spithill in Galway. But it's St Enda's that are the real story. 3,000 fans were at this game. It was the All-Ireland Intermediate semi-final. And, Brawley just paints the litany of horrors they've endured as a club.
In the trouble.
Yeah. So, 1972, they had their clubhouse burnt down. They had glass put on their pitch. They had a booby trap bomb in a flask on the side of the pitch. 1972 again, they had their changing rooms bombed. They had 8 arson attacks on their clubhouse. 1978, the UDR came in and cut down their goalposts. 1983, their clubhouse burnt down again, and there was grenades lobbed over their protective fence onto their ground. 1993, their president was assassinated, that's Sean Fox. In 1997, their manager, Jerry Devlin, was shot dead outside the grounds. Joe talks of this All-Ireland Intermediate semi-final in Park Tailteann in Navan, and the joy that he got out of watching this game.
Mm.
And Joe can sometimes be you know, a great critic of his own sport, which I know he doesn't do lightly. He's doing it with the best of intentions. But the piece starts with such violence and such horrendous litany of challenges for this club, and ends with Joe just standing there being a proud person involved in this organisation. And a fabulous read, read actually.
Because the match finishes in poignant circumstances as well. A few minutes to go, there's a 36-year-old Philly Curran who comes on, and he gets a huge ovation, and he's the most number of senior appearances for the club. But Brawley says that's not why he received such a thunderous welcome, because back in 01 he would have played with a Jared Lawler, and they were both on the same team, and they were playing in a match back in 02. Afterwards, they were out for a few drinks, watched the Sunday game. Jared said his goodbyes. They never saw him alive again. He was murdered by loyalists shortly after leaving the club, and the cheer on Sunday gone was as much for the dead boy as Philly. He says, that 18-year-old was the last ever Catholic shot dead by loyalists. What an effing shame. I looked around as they clapped and saw tears, hard not to shed with myself. So the whole thing was dripping in layers and poignancy.
And sometimes Joe's pieces can read like, I've said it before, a brief where he's trying to prove an argument. This is a beautifully well-written piece where he's not trying to prove a point or justify his view on certain rules. He's just regaling what he did one Sunday afternoon. It's very nice.
Yeah, no, it's well worth a look. Colm O'Rourke beneath him, by the way, is absolutely disgusted with the ticket price raised. Dennis Walsh is writing about it, as well as Shane McGrath in the papers. Nobody, it seems, is too enamoured with the GAA raising ticket prices. So that's part of the papers as well. We're pretty much done, unless you want to point someone very briefly in the direction of anything. Are we good?
No, I'm
good.
Yeah, we're all finished. Are you happy?
We're done.
You happy?
Don't go that far.
Paul Kimmich from the Sunday Independent and Gary O'Toole, thank you both for coming in. We'll take a short break.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.